Welcome to season 4 of Conscious Conversations. This season is titled The Educational Experience as Self-Knowledge. We explore learning not merely as instruction, but as a sacred embodied practice, a way of becoming, transforming, and returning to ourselves. I am your host, Mabato Monze, a spiritual practitioner, independent transdisciplinary researcher, and spherical guide. My work is rooted in Africana womanist ecometaphysics and grounded in indigenous knowledge systems. This podcast is an offering, a living archive of memory and possibility. Together with teachers, artists, visionaries, and cultural workers, we enter conversation as ritual, as recovery, and as reimagining. Welcome. Thank you so much, Riel, for joining us in this conscious conversation. We are excited to be sharing season 4, which will be released soon. And I'm happy that you could join us, in this season, especially because of your role in futures literacy. Having read a bit about your work, you're the first person who has introduced me to futures literacy. And from what I've been reading, it is not a new concept at all. And so it would be interesting to hear why it has not been that taken up institutionally, just in terms of curriculum and so on. But before we get to all of that, who is Riel Miller? I know that you have a PhD in economics, so it would be interesting to get to know a bit more about that journey. Please share a bit about yourself with our community.
Thank you. First of all, I feel honored and privileged to be able to have this conversation. It's important for me to be able to engage and to share and be part of what you're doing and part of the big world that we live in. So I'm appreciative of that. So I'm a retired international civil servant. And for many years, I've worked for international organizations. And in fact, I grew up as a United Nations child. And so I have a very long history of working in the international field and trying to make sense of the differences that I encountered from the time of being very small. And so that's a lot of what my journey has been about, is the sense, on the one hand, that there's no way to really know the other. And that as much as we get invited in, we're negotiating constantly. And I do feel that inadequacy to a certain extent all the time. But over the years, I think, perhaps by necessity, right, you turn that into being something that feels like a handicap or a loss, and realize that you don't need to play to that dualism. There is no way of knowing perfectly the other, even if you've lived all your life in one place. So the ambition, or the proposition, the aspiration of that security, right, feeling secure because, oh, I know exactly what they're saying. I think I spent a lot of my life figuring out that that's not worth bothering with. And so then it opens up, I think, a wonderful, let's call it menagerie, of different ways of understanding people and the world around you and what it means to be alive. So that's kind of what's happened to me over the years.
Sure, that is quite intense. I don't know how I'm hearing that, and immediately what came to me is if understanding and completely hearing the other is, I don't want to use the word serious, but you know, it's intimate, right? What more about understanding the self? And as you know, my work is around decolonization simply because of my own history. And when I think about the process of uncovering or discovering the self before we even get to the other, it is such an all-encompassing experience. And I'm wondering how. Sure. I'm wondering how perhaps the world or modernity has handicapped our capacity for that deeper sense of communion with the self, first of all, because I feel like we can only really meet others with the same depth that we meet ourselves, you know, in terms of whether we can understand the other, how we see the other, how we relate with the other, and the reality of colonization, productivity, ongoing colonialism, and whether the majority of the world really has the capacity or the space in their lives to get to know themselves or to understand themselves outside of the superficial categories that have been imposed on us as humanity overall. Sure.
So I think this is a really important thread that actually connects us up quite nicely to futures literacy in the following sense. And it was not in any way a kind of direct road or even a conscious planned or a objective on my part, but because I felt the reality of the arbitrariness of things. And I'll just give you a really, kind of like mundane example. By the time I was, I don't know, 6 or 7, I'm not the only person who's had this experience. I'd encountered at least 4 different or 5 different kinds of English, right? Because I was born in Saskatchewan and moved to Ottawa, then moved to New York, then moved to Rome, et cetera, et cetera. And there was British and there was American English in Rome and things like that. And so I'd had these 5 different kinds of English come into my life. And I suppose when people and so my daughter, for instance, who's a complete bilingual French and English, have this ability to see that in two languages, they're just the concepts are different, the ways of thinking are different. But what struck me about it most of all was how arbitrary it was. In other words, there was no real justification for why you pronounce things one way or why one word means one thing in one place and one. And that arbitrariness may be perhaps, and I mean, maybe I'm just doing retrospective, rationalization or narrative on this, but to a certain extent, it gave me a lightness. In other words, I kind of gave up because I thought it would drive me crazy to find out, some sort of essentialist position. I gave up on essences, I think, a long, long time ago, and felt really that things were much more transient, ephemeral in the moment. And that wasn't because I was particularly tuned in to, being in the moment or but the openness of things demonstrates right away that if you're going to try and totalize, encompass, or consolidate, or monumentalize, these are the terms that I'm using these days, or the way that we in embrace the curation of our memory of who we are, if you fix that too much, you're going to sink. Boom, you're just going to end up at the bottom of the pool. And so I had the privilege, and I think it is certainly a privilege because of all sorts of reasons, you know, being a white male in a privileged northern environment, where I wasn't being consciously or explicitly oppressed. That doesn't mean that I didn't have to contend with aspects of oppression, which I think we all do. But given that sense of security that I had, I could embrace a certain lightness to all of that, which I think is quite, you know, connected up with then embracing change and realizing that the way I understood things at one moment were not necessarily the way I understand things at the next moment. And furthermore, that I'm going to be continuously learning, testing, questioning, doubting what I understand about the others and about myself and about the context that I'm in. Now, there's quite a bit of insecurity in all of that, what I was just saying. But again, I think that's where my privilege really counted, because it was an insecurity that I could handle mostly at the level of reflection and thought, not at the level of physical insecurity.
Which is what I really find to be an enriching part of my human experience. So that ability to reflect and to, not do things purely because I have to survive, although that is the thing that is, over my head. But I do consider myself to be privileged, just in relation to my peers in South Africa. And I wish that more people had the opportunity to do that, because that's where I think we then get to think, why am I doing things this way? Is it because I've just been told that's how things have always been? Or it is because I am consciously choosing to do it this way. Am I doing it this way because it has a material impact on my livelihood, as an example. So all of those things, I think, have a lot to do with how we can imagine the future. And I think our capacity or spaciousness to sit with the unknown or with the unseen, right? And I feel like this is where futures literacy comes in an environment or context where the majority of the populace is not does not have that sense of security. I think now more than ever in our lifetime, at least, it has become a stark reminder because we see it, almost everywhere. So what does it mean for futures literacy? How do we begin to listen to what is emerging?
You know, as I was thinking about this conversation, I think that that's kind of the thread that I wanted to make sure we touched on. Now, the term futures literacy is meant to be a kind of overarching category, like agriculture or biology. There's lots of different aspects of biology. There's lots of different aspects of agriculture. So futures literacy is meant to be an overarching kind of category, and it's a category that's meant to represent the diversity of what I call anticipatory systems and processes. Now, that means that you have many different futures literacies, plural, because different people in different places have put together anticipatory systems and processes in different ways. Just the way you can do, you know, industrial agriculture in different ways in China than in Canada, or you can do organic agriculture differently in France than in Morocco. You know, I mean, these things are overarching categories, and then there are subcategories, and you have to define the subcategories by looking at the components. And part of the components, one way of thinking about this is to think about frames. So this is the idea that there's a frame, and inside the frame provides us with the reference points that we then use to describe what's inside the frame. And so, and this is all, quite analytical and descriptive. And what I was trying to do is find a way to make sense of what I was encountering, which is this immense diversity in the way people imagine what does not exist. And you can see it right away when you start to look across cultures and you see the some of the founding myths, right? So the myth of the hero's journey and the way people then think about the future from the point of view of how the hero will save the day. This is a very powerful structuring myth. It's the Marvel comics, it's the Homer's Odyssey. It's very, very powerful. And in many, many cultures, there are these similar stories of the person or the community that played a decisive role in establishing some form of story, some form of thing. And what I want to try to do is somehow, at the same time as I want to be suspicious of my analytical kind of preferences, my analytical way of looking at it, I want to be very cautious about the fact that if you actually have a different anticipatory system and process, et cetera, you don't see things analytically. You know what I mean? Is that of course my epistemology is going to betray me. And insofar as I'm trying to create an epistemology that is pluri-epistemic, my point of departure is still kind of, how do I create a pluri-epistemic epistemology? That's already a goal and a target. Now, I claim to do that by saying that the imagination cannot be known in just one way. And once you say that, I think you open the door to many, many different ways of knowing the imagination through dance, through music, through spirituality, through ghosts and ancestors, through physics, and the songs of the stars. So I think it does provide that open platform, but it's still inherently reductionist, and it's still inherently totalizing, and it's still inherently, kind of consolidating all those things that I'm suspicious of. And I really do wonder, why we bother. And so, I mean, maybe this comes back to what you were trying to help me talk about, which is, how do we find the comfortable position between what we're inheriting and our own lives? Because frankly, the past is unbelievably heavy. And I mean, it can be the heaviness of all this concrete and all these food chains that we have, supply chains and, highways and cars and oil and energy. I mean, that's pretty heavy stuff. We spend an immense amount of time, I mean, probably the largest part of our active lives, just maintaining that crap from the past. But I'm still carrying this epistemic baggage. Why do I want to analytically understand the diversity of anticipatory systems? What is it that motivates me? What is it that I'm trying to do? Why should I bother? Why shouldn't I just live it? And who cares, in fact, about whether it's, futures literacy that can be diffused around the world? And so that troubles me. It does, because when I start to think about colonialism, I mean, I don't think that colonialists started out to say, let's do evil. I don't think that's what they were, you know, up to. And so, but I don't think that because you're innocent of in terms of your intention that you're necessarily doing a good thing. And so people have said the idea of futures literacy is itself a kind of colonizing proposition. And so I wrestle with that. And I don't think anything can be pure. So I'm not too troubled by the lack of purity. But I do want to be attentive and as consistent to my own moral and ethical reference points, to continuously weaken the solidification, you know, the congealing, to keep things fluid, to keep things open, to keep things questioning, to be ready to let things die, to let go, to not be feeling, not feel the obligation out of some sort of sacredness that is imposed on me from the past. So it's quite a wrestle, actually. It's kind of like a, you know, in the thick of it.
And for me, it brings a couple of things up. So firstly, hearing you speak about futures literacy, and what comes up for me now is I kind of gravitate towards seeing futures literacy as, so you know, there's indigenous worldview and then there is non-indigenous or dominant Western worldview. For me, it feels like futures literacy could be a worldview that informs how we engage with other disciplines, for example. Because if we take some of the principles, for example, of staying open, and you know, the discipline of anticipation is an example to how we imagine the future and how we think about concepts like development, especially in non-colonizing ways, perhaps futures literacy could be that kind of worldview approach that people who do not want to lean into indigenous worldview too much or the dominant worldview too much can sort of like find a middle ground. Because I, having interacted with your playbook, I'm seeing how one is borrowing from these different worldviews and how that can work. So I am of the view that not everything that is Western is inherently wrong or evil. There are a lot of things I've come to appreciate, especially as an emerging scholar and researcher about the Western worldview. For example, something like writing as a form of documentation. I mean, you look at South Africa or African epistemologies, mostly transferred orally. And now we can see that for someone like myself, who's often trying to trace your history then becomes problematic because I think our histories do have some sort of impact on who we are and how we see the world because it has a lot to do with place where you are at right now. And for me, that place begins with my own body. So how I understand my identity, my worldview, how I do things, how I respond to things has a lot to do with where I come from. And where I come from comes with its own history and baggage. And in the context where you come from has all this negative baggage that has been hyper vocalized, then becoming yourself, that neutral self that is able to flow with ease, it becomes important that you do the underground work. So you can't just get to a place where you are able to flow without understanding all of these things that often distort your own personality. I don't know if you have any reaction to that.
I think we're on the same page here, really. In the following sense, at least from my perspective, to boil it all down, the issue becomes the capacity to be free. So it's a capability-based perspective. It's not a goal-based perspective. And what it means to be free is different under different circumstances. And it's not, there's no such thing as absolute freedom. There's the issue of how you exercise your own joy in living. Okay. And of course, that's very tightly connected to how your body expresses that joy. So it's not there's no mind body distinction here. This is you are the expression, you are the performance of your joy and your fear and your sorrow and your pain. And if the capacity to be free is to be able to do that, to live it while we're alive, with the awareness that it ends, because I think that's important, and keeping that in mind is really crucial. Then I would like to think that in the caring and love that we give to the world, of which one aspect is intergenerational, related to reproduction, not necessarily biological directly, but the reproduction in the communities that we are part of, that intergenerational transfer is not a transfer of me, but a transfer of what I've learned about learning. And that if, or the way to think about this is to create, as best we can, based on our experiences, the conditions that will allow the metacognition to occur, meaning wisdom. So, to say it another way, how can we make sure that everybody becomes wise in their own way, becomes wise from their own experience, becomes wise in ways that allow them to be a wise member of the community? So that's not somebody who's teaching, people lessons or sort of, saying they know the way. That's not at all what I mean. It's not wisdom as something on high. It's wisdom as living well.
I love it.
Yeah. So I mean, their futures literacy, by the way, is pretty, in my mind, pretty explicitly about that, because what I'm because I'm trying to make sense of it from where I start, which is very historically and specific, but it's, I think, exactly what you were talking about, which is this kind of cross-cultural east, west, north, south. What can we do that in a way of finding a vocabulary and a way of talking about what I would, in my work calls anticipation for the future and anticipation for emergence? How do we consolidate the learnings of a walkabout? So if you take indigenous knowledge systems, many of them have very deep experiential pedagogies. So the way of learning is to go out there and to fuck up, to fall down, to do the, and you're not even, you don't even know what you're supposed to be learning, and you don't even have a rubric for it. Well, go out there and learn. Well, okay, but I mean, well, go to this mountain or go to this thing, do that thing, and then see and come back and tell me. And that sounds incredibly unstructured, right? And very difficult to curate, from the point of view of, hey, if I want to curate a museum, I know that I can put a painting or a statue in the museum from an artist. So, you have all the criteria, the parameters. You know exactly how to curate your memory. And if you go to school, they tell you exactly how to curate your success. You have to pass the test. You have to be able to say this. You have to know what the Nobel Prize winners had to say about it, etc. But here you are, when it comes to wisdom, not only are you searching for something that you don't know how to curate, because it's going to be your own criteria, so you have to discover the criteria. It's kind of like lifting yourself up by your bootstraps. You say, well, I can't levitate, how am I going to figure that out? And then furthermore, you're not going to preserve it. or push it on anybody else, it's going to disappear when you die. So that aspect of ephemerality, improvisation, spontaneity, not knowing, not doing, that aspect of the emptiness of the world around us, which we're continuously filling up, but also continuously emptying out. That's kind of what I think I'm trying to do in my context. And I'm not, you know, but I'm by the long shot, you know, not the first, because we have many, many, many people in human history who have tried to talk about these things. I just think we've been really not very good at growing up. In other words, the pedagogy of the dominant civilizations, so I include East, West, North, and South here, has been hierarchical, monarchical, patriarchal, extractive, oppressive. And that way of learning sucks. It's infantile in the sense of infantile, you know, treating people like they're not humans. And to me, that's something that, and I don't care if it's, you know, successful for the species in terms of, you know, how long the species lasts. I don't, you know, if the species disappears, it disappears. What matters to me is that it's the pleasure you get out of life. It's living well now for the people who are alive now. And so this is where futures literacy, I think, applies pretty much everywhere, because everybody can relate to it, because everybody's struggling with time, learning, openness, not knowing. Everybody's struggling with, you know, the issues around wisdom and security, insecurity, fear and hope, the weakness of our imagination. That's another thing that really, you know, I think that we share is this. When people's imaginations are weak, it's very easy to manipulate them.
I think I used to read a lot growing up. I remember in grade 10, my English teacher, she threw a book on my table and she was like, "Mama, to take. You seem to be the only one who reads in this class, you know?" So I think although the environment I grew up in did not encourage reading, because libraries, for example, were not necessarily, a thing in my environment, I found other ways of learning, and I think it helped that I loved to read and I spoke a lot, which sometimes got me into trouble, because my classmates would call me teacher's pet, and bully me, which had its pros and cons.
I was called walking dictionary.
Oh, is it? Oh.
Would make fun of me. Look at all those words he's using.
But I am thinking about emergence, how you speak about how we grow into ourselves and how we relate with our communities and the world has a lot to do with how we experience life, how we see ourselves, the wisdom we've been able to cultivate through our experiences. And the intergenerational connection, right, that we cannot ignore. We raise children to a certain degree, we condition them. How do we think about creating an environment where emergence and anticipation become a normal way of seeing the world and approaching life? Without also losing the idea of intergenerational knowledge, because in my world, it feels important. So, for example, values. There are certain values my mother taught me. For example, like working hard. She used to say, "If you don't work hard, you will." And that is something that stayed with me up until now. And despite the circumstances I found myself in, I always remembered that. So in terms of, she didn't necessarily tell me how to work hard, and I'm not doing it how she worked hard, right? But I understand it as a practice, and as a form of taking responsibility and accountability for myself and how I want to live. So where does emergence, inheritance, and growth, where do they meet? How do we not think about inheritance in a negative necessarily way? Because for me, it supports me. Like some of the things I remember about my ancestral way of life, it feels like it's a metaphysical transmission because, again, the environment broadly has not demonstrated the value of Botho or Ubuntu, as it is, globally known. I've experienced it because I would not be here. But when I drive up the road from where I live and I see so many young people, like it's been school holidays now, they dance at the traffic lights and, they are hoping to get money. But when they left their homes, they've gone to seek a livelihood. And I feel like it is such it is such a burden at that young age to have to go dance at the intersection because you have to buy bread. How come it doesn't bother most people? If yeah, because it feels like it doesn't for me.
But I mean, I think, if I can distinguish the aspects here, what was really interesting to me about what you said about work was that your mother did not say, I want you to be a doctor. I want you to be, the way you described it, it was work hard, but in a sense, it was an invitation to follow your curiosity and your passion. And it's cliche, Hollywood cliche to say, follow your passion. But one of the things that I've never been able to figure out, and it remains quite in some ways a disturbing mystery, is the way our curiosity works. Because if people become experts in all kinds of things, and what are they really doing? I think, some of it you can be curious because you think it's functional. Like, I'm curious about fixing a car because then I can get a job. But I don't think that's the way it works. I'm curious about football clubs. I'm curious about dancing. I'm curious about these things because you want to, because there's such a pleasure in becoming more able, using our being alive to become more able, and to savor the richness of things by delving into them. Why does this spice taste good? Why does this ritual satisfy me? Why? And to understand more about it. And I think that's where I mean, again, not at all the only person to say this, but I mean, learning becomes the really central value, the thing that is valuable, that's meaningful. And creating the conditions where learning is healthy is, I think, one of the huge challenges that we have, because I think a lot of learning is not healthy. A lot of learning is about winning and success. A lot of learning is about commodification, and finding ways to survive in an alienated and commodified world. And so, we live in a really ridiculous moment historically. I think, I mean, if I think, 10,000 years from now, this is going to seem like a really weird period, because we're really out of whack from my point of view. We're really imbalanced in all sorts of different ways. And I mean, unfortunately, I think that, it's not like I want to talk about this in terms of welfare or optimization, but I think that the kind of, I don't know, you call it the aggregate karma, is probably pretty low in this period, because life is, you're commuting, you're sitting in a car, you're dancing to get bread. I mean, what is this? What a terrible way to organize life on this planet for this species. And it's not that I want to plan a way of doing it better, because I think the planning is God, what got us into this mess to begin with, because we tried to play God, small g. But I do have this, and this is just a scenario optimism on my part, that if we talk, if we continue to talk about what you and I are talking about, which I think is this question of what do we gift? And so your mother gifted the liberty of your curiosity. And if we can do more of that, we can have more fun. We have more play, and begin to dispense with all of this worship and fear. Because worship and fear, I worship the highway, I worship the car, I worship the job, I worship the university diploma, and all that worshiping is really fear related. Because you think, I need to have the job in order to survive. I need to have the diploma to get the status. I need to, and what you're doing is you're just feeding the beast.
Absolutely. Absolutely. At your own expense a lot of the time, because excuse me, some of these success markers come at a great expense of what is personal, you know. But I'm curious about the idea of what is emerging. I think global politics, globalization, we are seeing that something is definitely dying and something new is emerging. How do we begin to think about this period in sort of like that emergent way that allows us to use our imaginations to anticipate the future and to think about maybe how we can do things differently as we are transitioning, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a huge. I mean, actually, to me, the only way of dealing with what you just talked about, the kind of transitions, change, is experiment, experiment, experiment. Look at those experiments and all, and question the way in which you evaluate those experiments. In other words, the way in which you think they're a success or a failure. So let's take social media. Let's say, you put out music or dance or fashion or whatever it is you put out on social media, an expression of yourself, right? To what extent is that expression conformist? To what extent is that expression driven by the desire to be popular? So scale, those are pretty heavy duty pressures, parameters. But insofar as expressing yourself is a creative act and is part of being who you are, and it's not successful on the old criteria, you're not an influencer, but you are refining your own sense of prose, of music, of self. You are engaged in intense and channel learning opportunities with others. So like for instance, the exchanges that you and I have. I mean, are we doing this because we think it's going to have a million followers? I don't think so. And so in other words, it has inherent value because the value that it has is right now. Honestly, it's right now. It's what's going on, what we're doing. It's ephemeral. It might not last. Can I explain to somebody else what that's about? Do I care to explain to somebody else what it's about? No, it's just my life, and that's enough. And so I guess the transitions that I'm thinking about are transitions really away from the largely conventional frameworks for saying this is success, this is achievement, this is security, this is and trying to let go of that. Now, do I know what that will look like? No, I don't know what that will look like. Do I know if it will be better or worse? I don't know. But I think we need to become more confident that not knowing is fine. To me, that's and I, you know, this is not the most perfect way of thinking about it, but if you think about it from the point of view of maturity, you know, when you're a child, you need to be protected for lots of reasons, and denied direct experience of certain things, getting burned, falling off, da da da. You need to be protected because that's we're vulnerable, and we have a lot to learn, and our bodies are not complete, and et cetera. But as we mature, do we need to be shielded from ambiguity? Do we need to be shielded from discontinuity, death, endings? Do we need to be obsessed with conformity and success that's recognized through accolades and tributes? I don't think so. I think we need to be liberated to say, I don't care. That's not really what matters. And so I don't know what the configuration is of a transition away from what we have, because all I can say is that I know what we've had and I don't like it.
Season 4 of Conscious Conversations has been brought to you in creative partnership with Atomic Shoots.
And in my own world, the acknowledgement of I think people can only process or let go of assumptions once they have interpreted certain things for themselves with their experiences. But as we've already discussed, the problem is many people do not have that opportunity to see that, oh, actually, this idea of success that I desire so much actually doesn't mean anything. But how am I living well? How am I spending enough time with my children? How am I contributing in regenerative ways? What kind of relationship do I have with myself? I think the conversations or discussions around trauma, they have indicated a lot around why people do what they do and why fear has been such a dominant feeling or emotion in our time and what that has created or reproduced as well. So, yeah, I think it's very challenging because, again, thinking about institutions, if one has a project and you are working with institutions that expect their budget to be accounted for with specific outcomes, how do we then transition?
That's one of the strongest forces of reproducing the past is the budget and accounting. But let me pick up on the point that I think is very important, and I wonder about this. I like to think, but I'm not sure, that the imagination provides us an entry point into what you're talking about. So let's say, you know, somebody imagines being famous, right? As a goal, but they haven't really thought about it too much, and they haven't exercised their imagination. You know, so it's a bit like saying, you know, I want to do a marathon, but I haven't started the training. Yeah, what a nice idea, but you know, and then you start to do the training, and then either you find out you don't like it, or you know, you find you love it, but you actually know what it's more about. You know, you get the you have that experience, and it seems to me that the imagination or play simulation can play this role. Simulation can give us a lot more than and so simulation is not realistic in the sense that it's not real. It's simulation, it's games, it's playing. And I'm a great believer in that kind of let's call it, you know, solution, that by exercising our imaginations, we get stronger. By being stronger, it's easier to climb the stairs. Okay. Climbing the stairs is simulating and saying, what's it like to be famous? What's it like to be this? What's it like to be that? What's it like? And by playing with that, we actually can really become, you know, more kind of confident and more open to emergence. Why? Because we've experienced emergence through simulation and play. So the direction that my work has taken with respect to futures literacy is precisely this idea of play and simulation. And here, I think there's really a strong and powerful position of the future. Because the future does not exist, it has to be imagined. It's inherently a place to play and to simulate. You can't do anything else. And I think that a lot of the established orders have used that seductive power of the imaginary, let's call it going to heaven. But then they stopped there, right? They gave you the kind of satisfaction of knowing, well, there's a later. It's going to be just great. Okay. Make America great again later. Okay. And then your imagination goes to sleep. No. Imagine for real. Okay. Like go for it. And think about, okay, I'm in the future. What's it like? What's it like? Fill it up. Fill it up with details. You know, how does it actually function and work? And that's where futures literacy it kind of gets nurtured. That's the fertilizer for the garden of your imagination, play simulation, thinking about things in different ways, using different frames. And so, you know, in part, given the aspirations and the values of democratization, we may be in a good position to rebel against the monopoly of the imagination by the elites. It has been very effective and powerful for the elites to dominate hope and fear in the future. So futures literacy, in that sense, is fundamentally meant to be subversive. But it's not only subversive, I think, of the kind of reproduction of hierarchical security, but I think it's subversive of keeping us as children.
I have a particular relationship with that concept, and I think the idea of adults needed in society, yes, but I think adults tend to take themselves too seriously.
The other way around, you're right. The adults become children for play and for, but that's the ridiculous thing is that we should be adults should play, adults. And actually, you're right. The vocabulary is captured. You're right.
In thinking about what you are saying, I think about young people here in South Africa, who have lots of dreams. I'm one of those young people, and how structurally you can imagine all you want, you can dream all you want, but if systematically, structurally, you are excluded from being able to experiment with those dreams and imagination, then I've heard people say, what's the point? What's the point? Because even if I go seek funding, only connected people get funding. And I see how these things work, only and I feel I think I'm a very resilient person, and I have this kind of like I persist, right? And I'm afraid that sometimes not everyone has got that capability. It's still something that needs to be cultivated, right? Now, when people's experiences are hardened and so heartbreaking, before they have cultivated that capability to be resilient, what is the point of dreaming and using your imagination if then the question is going to be, but like I can't materialize these things, because it's a
Yeah.
very
Oh, you're, yeah. Yeah,
it's reality.
no, you're right. I mean, I kind of hide from that very good question or challenge behind the very high level and in the sense of, historically general and also many, many years conversation about what does it mean for a rural peasant to learn how to read and write so that they can live in the city. So my grandparents went through that transition when they moved from Eastern Europe to Canada. They learned to read and write. They learned to be able to live in an urban industrial environment where before they'd been in a rural agricultural environment. And the transition was brutal, full of trauma. I mean, I think it's not like I don't want to say they there were lots of things that they could not have about their lives because they had to make those voyages, which were very difficult. And of course, many people didn't survive, and many people suffered in lots of different ways. So, to compare futures literacy to learning to read and write, I mean, these days, it seems to me fairly obvious that given all the circumstances of which values and technologies, tools are a part, being futures literate is crucial to be able to be at home or comfortable in today's world. In the same way that being able to read and write, was it crucial if you were going to live in the urban city in an industrial society. But that doesn't really address your point because we're still in a situation where a lot of people can't read and write. We're still in a situation where a lot of people are illiterate. And the difficulty of making that transition is huge. So I mean I mean I imagine in my mind, okay, the idea that if you can let go of the catch up and convergence view of development. So when I'm a child or an adolescent, I want to become like an adult. When I'm a small city, I want to become like a big city. When I'm like Johannesburg, I want to become like Singapore, or whatever. If I'm a technology hub, I want to become like Silicon Valley. That kind of catch up and convergence, those ways of thinking about the future, those ways of thinking about the future are incredibly sterile. They're false, for one thing, because it didn't happen that way. And they create envy and disappointment, and dependency. So when you're in a situation where you're dancing for your food, for the money to get food, you're in such a dead end that because you're hoping somehow you're going to break out and get on the path of development. But it's false. It's a false hope and it's a false image. The idea of futures literacy would be to let go of that. Of course, that's a huge ask because that's already there. You can already see the adults doing their thing. Your hero is already your hero because they are doing something heroic. New York City is New York City. It's the metropolis. It's already there. And to say to people, let go of those images which are not yours. Get that the colonization of your imagination out of your head and be able to invent something that's of value in your own context. And there, really picking up also on your ancestors, picking up on the way value was created in your community, because your community certainly created value. But it didn't necessarily create it through commodification or industry. But this is a huge ask. I mean, it's gigantic and very, very difficult. And it's not adequate really for me to say that, particularly from the safety and the comfort of my life. So I feel very inadequate and humble by that kind of question.
I think it has a lot to do with education as well, right? If we were educated differently, then how we think about what we want to create or how we want to live becomes different. And it makes me think about the other day I was reading the Futures Literacy Playbook, and I was thinking about children and how this would be such, I think, innovative work to do with children. So my younger son goes to a Montessori school, and They divide them in like age groups, and one can see how that that age group creates a space for learning. And I was just thinking about how futures literacy might be instrumental in helping younger people become future literate. Because when you think about where we are at right now, as a 37-year-old, I probably have got my own conditioning, I've got my own ways of viewing success and all of these things, then that make it hard to then imagine a different future, right? So what potential do you think futures literacy has, especially with young children and perhaps being part of curriculums, projects, and so on?
So one of the things really to keep in mind is the study of anticipatory systems and processes, the diversity, the different sources, the different frames, the analytical frames, the narrative frames, all of this is still relatively early days in terms of the research. I have a hypothesis that needs to be tested. I have anecdotal evidence and evidence from my own experience in life that points in this direction, which is that children are really testing and experimenting with one set of anticipatory systems and processes, and they're very related to certainty. You want to be certain that you don't get hit by a car. You want to be certain that you get dinner. You want to be certain that you don't get burned by the stove. You want to be certain, that you do what you're told to do because that's what's safe, etc. So children are testing, experimenting, perfecting, practicing the habits and the perspectives, the perception that's related to what I would call probabilistic, based on past and based on experience. And what's wonderful about children is that, at least that I notice, in my own life, is that they continuously are experimenting and testing. Pretty wildly, actually, because they don't even have the epistemologies they need to consolidate the learning. So they're just doing the test over and over and over again, sometimes falling, sometimes dropping, sometimes this. And eventually they figure out the reference points, the rules of the game. By playing, they learn the rules, and then the rules get easier to use, and then they become more familiar. When you move outside of that survival probabilistic, what I call anticipation for the future, perspective, you then begin to encounter anticipation for emergence. Anticipation for emergence really runs on a different epistemology and a different logic. You can't use the probabilistic way of learning and knowing for emergence because it's not probable. It's not related to that. And one of the things that we've systematically denied children in most hierarchical societies is the opportunity to not play the game by the rules that lead to success. So passing the test, being, conforming to the rules, learning the rules so you can succeed, has dominated education systems around the world for many centuries. There's been indigenous societies, obviously, that have not adopted that approach. But I think that here we have the challenge of thinking, how do we create conditions in which not knowing is safe and encouraged? And I do think that it might be difficult to do that with young children, because here when I talk about imagination, it's not about being imaginative. I mean, the nice thing about young people often is that they're liberated from the past. They don't know. And so they'll invent something and they say, wow, popcorn, that's incredible. Well, yeah, we've already had popcorn. It already exists, but it is cool. It's great, that you invented it. And so, and also they're uninhibited and rebel. So they break boundaries. But that to me is not really the kind of imagination I'm talking about. The kind of imagination I'm talking about has got more categories to it, and differentiates different kinds of imagination. So I think that it is like a literacy in that sense, is that learning the alphabet is one thing, but learning, poetry is another thing.
So I'm thinking about a concept like economics, right? We usually participate in tuck shop days. And, the reality of globalization of technology, say, for instance, in a senior primary school, how children are taught to think about economics or business because they are doing it. For me, in a futures literacy scenario, I'll take economics as an example, and I'll say, let's create a product as an example. How do we think about creating value or adding value to this? And for me, their capability to imagine different forms of value adding other than what we know now through capitalism would be what trains futures literacy in that sort of like space.
I mean, like I said, young people are often uninhibited by, that doesn't work because they don't know that it doesn't work. So, for instance, that leads to a certain degree of liberation. But having run many, 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 many exercises where I've invited people to think about the future, it is really hard to escape from commodities, demand and supply, transactions, money, and even a very young age. I mean, what I often say is that one of the most powerful sources of humanity's relationship to time in today's world is money. Money is introduced very early, and money is a temporal concept. Money is a relationship to time. Time is money, and money lasts over time. Money has value tomorrow. So our understanding of past, present, and future, our understanding of, in the moment, time is money, tick tock, tick tock. All of those things are super powerful and they inhabit people's imaginations. And if you're not aware of the extent to which your imagination is framed by those assumptions, by those reference points, it's very difficult to escape from that frame. So when I, in my work, it's often the question, thinking inside the box and thinking outside the box. Well, how do you know what the box is? And what's really cool is that when you ask people to describe the future, they will in fact describe their box because they're obliged to reveal their assumptions in order to describe the imaginary future. And then when you ask them to move beyond commodification, beyond this version of economics, then all of a sudden you're absolutely right. They begin to think about value in a different way. But then it's not just young people that do that, everybody can do that. Once you draw people's attention to the parameters, the frames, the boxes that their imagination is stuck in, they begin to go outside it because then they know where the line is. Otherwise, they're just improving what they already know. Oh, let's, well, we need bitcoins or we need cryptocurrency, and they'll go wild with cryptocurrency. But cryptocurrency is just, business as usual.
I was listening to a professor, I think from Portugal, De Sousa Santos, and he was saying in a 2019 lecture he did, he was saying it is scary to him that young people can imagine the end of the world, but they cannot imagine the end of capitalism.
Yes. But I mean, look, ap apocalyptic thinking was partly what I was talking about earlier, which is the invitation to think about apocalypse or, the afterlife or whatever you want to call it, is a solution to this problem of the future, which is so powerful. The future is incredibly powerful, and you need a solution to it. So you've got an apocalypse, you've got it, and you can adopt that. But then the question of how do you imagine day-to-day life? How do you describe something in detail from a functional perspective? That's where our imagination is completely weak. It's not a surprise that they can't. It's because nobody exercises it. If I, you know, if you haven't done any jogging and somebody says run a marathon, you're going to fall on your face. Okay? So this is one of the reasons why futures literacy emerged from my practice as a designer of processes, is to say you people cannot describe alternative futures because they just haven't spent time doing it, and they don't realize what we were just saying before, the extent to which their imagination is confined by the frames and the parameters within which they're imagining. So first of all, you need to draw attention to these frames and parameters. One of the aspects of those frames, one of part of the narrative frame, is that the future is meant to be utilitarian. So this immediately constrains our imagination. Be realistic. Keep your feet on the ground. Don't have your head in the clouds. Well, that immediately constrains your imagination. And people do that all the time in many, many different cultures. And so the result is really that we have this atrophied imagination that's stuck with a kind of pragmatic conformity that's very convenient for those in power. Why? Because it reproduces the past. And people in power, well, they were in power in the past.
We could go on and on and on around this theme, but I do want to get this one question in. The relationship between spirituality, futures literacy, or perhaps the discipline of anticipation. In an exchange we recently shared, I shared the idea of onelopele in Setswana or Sesotho, which means foresight, right? Which is a capability that I don't know how many people think about in their everyday life, which has a lot to do with wondering whether our choices reflect the desired result. And if they don't, at what point do we change? At what point do we not? And I think that goes on to continuity and all the rest of it, right? Your idea of spirituality, anticipation, futures literacy, do you think there's a connection?
Well, I have a probably a relatively tame version of spirituality in a sense, which is simply I'm a deep believer in the mystery of the universe. The universe is profoundly mysterious to me, and I'm that makes me feel good. I like that mystery. It's not for me a frightening mystery. It can kill me, but it's still deeply comforting to me that the universe is unknowable, creative, emergent, spontaneous, improvisational. The difference amongst people, kind of goes back to what we were saying at the beginning. I mean, I just found so much difference. Things were not repeating. People weren't saying the same words in the same way in, four different cities. They were saying in different ways. I just think difference is so wild, it's so crazy, and it inspires me a lot. And I guess the another maybe reference point was that I part of my childhood was spent walking around in the forests in Canada, and it was so obvious to me that the forest was not talking, but communicating, right? In ways that I couldn't explain. But that was a good thing.
So it means you believe in the unseen world.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Riol, for this conversation. Is there anything you'd like to share, that I have not asked with our community?
I just want to continue the conversation. That's all.
Thank you again, for this conversation. I'm going to stop recording now. Thank you for journeying with us in this episode of Conscious Conversations. May something spoken here return to you when you most need it, gently, powerfully, as a reminder of your wholeness. If this conversation moved you, I'd love to hear from you. You can connect with us through montsiem.com. Until next time, stay present, stay tender, and remember, you are not alone in the work of transformation and liberation. Yavingelela ngithi thokoza ngehlamadala.